U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do more to protect Palestinian civilians from attacks.
We need to do more to protect Palestinian civilians. As Israel conducts its campaign to defeat Hamas,
organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross are providing aid and support to those being affected by the Israel-Hamas war.
What we see today is not comparable to what we witnessed in the past in terms of the level of destruction, despair, and acute needs.
And we address an increase in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia since the Israel-Hamas war began. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Friday to urge the protection of Palestinian civilians as Israeli troops tighten their encirclement of Gaza City in the fighting with Hamas.
We need to do more to protect Palestinian civilians. We've been clear that as Israel conducts its campaign to defeat Hamas, how it does so matters.
Tensions escalated along the northern border with Lebanon after a speech Friday by Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the militant group Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed Hamas ally. It was his first speech since Hamas attacked Israel last month, stoking fears that the conflict could become a regional one. Nasrallah warned the United States on Friday that preventing a regional conflict depended on stopping the Israeli attack on Gaza and said there was a possibility of the fighting on the Lebanese front turning into a full-fledged war. Organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross and the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs are providing aid and support to those being affected by the Israel-Hamas war. I spoke with representatives of both organizations to discuss how they are addressing the humanitarian crisis there. First, I spoke with Andrea DiDomenico of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Andrea, can you please give us an overview of the current humanitarian situation within Gaza and other sections of Israel?
I've seen, of course, has been very largely reported from all over by media, the level of bombardment that has unfolded after the attacks on the 7th of October by the armed groups into Israel. The bombardment has started immediately after, and it has progressively increased in intensity. What people have to understand is Gaza is the only place in the planet that when bombardment starts, you cannot flee. It is a complete besieged area where people cannot escape and have no chances whatsoever to go out. If you add on top of it that the fact that Gaza is probably one of the most densely populated area in the world, you can easily imagine that the impact of heavy bombardments have a huge tolls on civilians that are caught in between the two parties that are fighting. So the numbers, you've seen them, I think we publicly put all the numbers, you know, we are more than 9,000 fatalities, more than almost 23,000 injuries on the Palestinian side, more than 1,400 fatalities on the Israeli side, and approximately 5,500 injuries on the Israeli side. So the scale of the impact is really, really unbelievably high. And that, of course, is also has triggered reaction and tensions on the West Bank, where we have the highest level of fatalities that we have recorded since the Second Intifada, where movements are completely blocked, where settler violence had been a little bit out of control. And that is, of course, creating a lot of tension. And for the first time, we have aerial bombardment even in cities inside the West Bank, targeting specific targets, but still having an impact, of course, on civilians that are caught in the middle.
What is your organization doing to assist those people in need?
So the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations has a mandate to coordinate the humanitarian response. The coordination means basically have a clear picture of where the needs are and try to make sure that those entities that deliver assistance are coordinated to deliver the priority and to meet the priority needs of people. Of course, it is a little bit, it has been quite chaotic in Gaza since the last 3 weeks. The evacuation order from the north forced us to move toward the south just to maintain our teams in safety and being able to continue operating. And since then, we've tried to reestablish our basic structure of coordination and response. The gigantic effort as of today is made, of course, by the colleagues of UNRWA, the United Nations agency that is working in Gaza since 70 years, providing basically the logistical support to respond to the immediate need of 1.5 million IDPs. 700,000 roughly are hosted in UN premises, UNRWA premises, so schools that have been transformed overnight, basically, in IDP centers. But then we have another 700,000 people and more, almost 800,000, outside of those centers. They are hosted by families and public infrastructure, schools, mosques, churches.
That was Andrea Di Domenico of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. I also spoke with Elizabeth Shaw of the International Committee of the Red Cross for the role they're playing in providing aid to those suffering during the Israel-Hamas war. Elizabeth, what is the International Committee of the Red Cross doing in Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank?
Well, we have been operating there for decades. Right now, we are very much focused with the recent escalation. The human misery we have seen unfold in the last weeks in both Israel and Gaza has been shocking. What we see today is not comparable to what we witnessed in the past in terms of the level of destruction, despair, and acute needs. And so what the ICRC does is we work to protect and assist those affected by the armed conflict and violence. And we remind the parties of their obligations under international humanitarian law. So that means civilians are always protected. They receive humanitarian assistance and they are not taken hostage, and that civilian infrastructure remains intact for basic survival. So right now, obviously, we have over 100 staff working in Gaza, and we are very focused on the level of acute needs. We have not seen this level of acute needs in previous escalations. The number of patients, for example, in the hospitals far exceeds the number of beds. So we know that many patients are going untreated. Hospitals and health centers have been working nonstop for weeks now in horrific circumstances, with doctors not knowing whether their own families have survived or been able to evacuate. They lack medical supplies, equipment, and personnel. The hospital system is basically on its knees.
I understand the ICRC is involved with the hostage situation in Gaza and working to facilitate the release of the hostages. What can you tell us about the work your organization is doing regarding this?
First and foremost, we want families to know that the suffering of loved ones being held hostage right now is one of our top priorities, and that we are speaking with Hamas face to face, as well as Israeli officials and others on this issue. And so we know the stakes are very high, and we welcome the release of so far 4 hostages, which the ICRC was able to facilitate. But we know that many other families continue suffering without any news of their loved ones. And so we are working to help the hostages and their families any way we can. That could mean visiting them in person to check on their health or to deliver personal medicines, or we could help deliver those medications or eyeglasses through an alternate channel. We are eager to help facilitate the exchange of simple messages between the hostages and their family members. And of course, we are ready to facilitate their release.
That was Elizabeth Shaw of the International Committee of the Red Cross. You're listening to VOA's Issues in the News. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The United States House of Representatives passed a bill Thursday night that would send aid to Israel. But it's where that money would come from and what's left out of the bill that all but guarantees it will never pass the Senate. VOA's Steve Koresh spoke with congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
So what the U.S. House of Representatives is considering Thursday is $14 billion in aid for Israel. Much of that is defense funding going to bolster Israel's air and missile defense systems. And part of it will also go to humanitarian needs in Gaza for Palestinians. Now, what we do know is that this is a House House Republican-initiated bill, which pays for the aid by cutting the budget of the Internal Revenue Service, which is basically the U.S. government agency that handles the taxation of Americans. And because it makes those cuts, it's a non-starter with Democrats, even those Democrats who support aid to Israel and say that it's important to make sure that the U.S. honors that commitment to them. So in all honesty, this bill is a non-starter. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, has already said that it's not going to be taken up in the Democratic Majority Senate. And so in a sense, this is just a first step, a bargaining chip as part of a larger discussion over the White House Emergency Supplemental Request, which is almost $106 billion and includes aid to Ukraine, aid to combat Chinese aggression, border security, and aid to Israel. So we are really just getting started up here on Capitol Hill.
Well, there's a lot to unpack with that answer. The first topic, the first issue really is, by taking money away from the Internal Revenue Service to fund that aid for Israel, Republicans, who have famously been budget hawks in the past, by taking away from the agency that brings money into the government, this seems to be going against their own philosophy, no?
By some accounts, yes. What Hill Republicans would tell us about this decision is that they feel that the Biden administration is incorrectly directing the IRS, and that by making those budget cuts, they're cutting the Biden administration's priorities. Talk to Democrats, and they'll say that this is merely a tax cut for the rich in disguise. So it really tells you how important a role the IRS plays in American life, because it really is how we bring in our revenue. And that tells you what each party wants to do in terms of funding priorities. So this is really a non-starter, because the Democratic majority Senate will never take it up with those IRS cuts in there.
And another issue that it brings to the forefront is the division in the Republican Party over aid to Ukraine. By leaving that out of the equation, they're sort of pushing that can down the road, no?
That's right. The White House said today that aid to Ukraine absolutely has to be bundled with aid to Israel, as it was in their emergency supplemental request. The White House pointed out that the point of an emergency supplemental request is that you're saying these are urgent funding priorities to protect U.S. national security. And by delinking all of them, you're merely saying that one is more important than the other. I've also heard some explanations that it's actually more useful to make these defense requests together.
That was VOA's Steve Karish speaking with congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. The Israel-Hamas war has sparked a tremendous increase in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, both here in the United States and elsewhere throughout the world. I spoke with experts on these issues from Michigan State University. First, Yael Aronoff, the chair of Jewish studies, shares her thoughts on the rise of anti-Semitism globally.
Yeah, it's been skyrocketing. And I just want to step back before doing that to express that it's already been at historic levels before October 7th. So the FBI has been tracking hate crimes since 1991. And of those religious-based hate crimes, even though Jews constitute 2% of the American population, they were a majority of the religiously based hate crimes since the recordings in 1991. The Anti-Defamation League, which has been keeping track of statistics since 1979, saw historic heights of anti-Semitism in the last couple of years, and each year it's growing by another 30%, by another 20%. So that's kind of the background of why the U.S. administration launched the campaign to fight anti-Semitism before October 7th. Since October 7th, the anti-Semitism in the United States has risen by 400%. And across different countries of the world, it's risen to also between 200% and 300%. And it's an extremely grave situation where, as you know, in Russia, Russia, by the way, invited Hamas, the deputy foreign minister, and actually praised apparently what they did on October 7th, which was massacre. massacring intentionally hundreds of civilians. In any case, in Russia itself, you had people storming. A whole airport has been locked down for the week because people were put in harm coming from a flight from Israel. There was a synagogue that was also burned down in Tunisia. There have been calls for killing Jews in different forums across the world. The Jewish Cultural Center in Russia, it's a death to Jews on it. In Germany and Italy, there's signs about Hitler, we'll see you again in hell. Protesters in Italy calling for killing the Jews. Molotov cocktails thrown at a synagogue in Germany. In Tunisia, as I said, a synagogue was burnt down. In the Turkish papers, an op-ed calling for Turkey's Jews to be stripped of their citizenship, and the list goes on and on. And in the United States, we've also seen frightening things, whether it be someone going into a Jewish family's house in L.A. and threatening to kill them, whether it be apparently a student at Cornell University this week that was threatening to kill Jews at the university, and that has to be that was reported by the attorney's office, and it needs to be, you know, of course, seen if this person is guilty. To students at different campuses, you know, some of them, you know, boarding themselves up in a library. So it's getting to the point where people have called for killing Jews and have threatened to kill Jews. And that's extremely frightening experience for many Jews across the world.
That was Yael Aronoff, the chair of Jewish studies at Michigan State University. Next, I am joined by Muhammad Khalil, director of Muslim studies at Michigan State University, who shares his thoughts on the increase in Islamophobia worldwide since the Israeli-Hamas conflict began.
Beginning with the October 7 attacks, we have been seeing a lot of Islamophobic rhetoric and discourse. And part of the problem is there's a tendency to conflate extremist actions with sort of the core of the tradition. There's this assumption that the extremists are sort of the real Muslims, and other Muslims are wishy-washy, apologetic Muslims. So this is already, and this is a problem that has been around for a long time. So that's one problem. The other problem, of course, is people may have an oversimplified understanding, a simplistic understanding of the situation in Gaza and Gaza, and maybe overlooking a lot of, you know, many of the reasons why people in those regions have grievances. And so there's a combination of factors there. And I think part of the problem also is that many of us, are in, echo chambers. We only hear one perspective. And so it's important for people to hear other perspectives. And, I think that's one reason for the rise in, Islamophobic rhetoric.
Could you give us examples of some of the most insidious hate crimes you've seen that have taken place since then?
Well, the one that really stands out locally here, or I should say domestically here in the United States, was the brutal murder of a six-year-old boy, a Palestinian boy, I believe his name is Wadia, living in Chicago. It would appear that the landlord of his apartment stabbed him, and of course tried to stab also his mother. This was a brutal attack, and of course, you know, it was such a tragic loss. And the reason, from what I understand, what is reported is that he at one point said something along the lines of, you know, Muslims should die or must die. And you can imagine this is someone who probably was encountering a lot of Islamophobic rhetoric, a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric. And this is someone who, according to the reports that we have, actually had a positive relationship with the family beforehand, before all this. So this is probably one of the most obvious examples. Beyond this, though, there are numerous accounts of people here who have felt reluctant to share their grievances, the feelings of sadness, because they feel that they will be, that there will be, they'll receive prejudicial treatment.
What efforts do you think are necessary to stem Islamophobia, the hate crimes, especially the violent ones?
I think what's necessary is we have to be careful what we say and how we present information. And it's important not to conflate Muslims with maybe extremist Muslims. And it's important that we get our facts straight. You know, unfortunately, there are many, we could say, pseudo scholars who pontificate, who discuss Islam in ways that are clearly inaccurate. Part of the problem is misinformation.
That was Muhammad Khalil, Director of Muslim Studies at Michigan State University. King Charles III and Queen Camilla went to Kenya for an official state visit. I spoke about the visit with correspondent Mariama Diallo in Nairobi.
A lot of people, when people that I've interviewed here, when the news came out that they were coming to visit Kenya, a lot of people wondered. They felt very special, the fact that this was the first royal visit to a Commonwealth country, not just that, in Africa, and the first one in Kenya. So they felt kind of special that the royal couple had chosen Kenya to visit on their first trip outside of Britain. As you know, they were in France and then they were in Germany. And I think Kenya became the third foreign country that they visited. So that was one. But the next question for other people were like, well, why Kenya? Why did they choose to visit our country? And not understandably, in Kenya, from what I've noticed during this trip, is that you have one side that's been very excited to see the royal couple. But on the other side, you have other people who are still wondering about the stuff that have happened during the colonial times, the effect it has had on the country and on certain communities. And so obviously continue to question a visit like this one.
Kenya will soon mark its 60th anniversary of independence after British colonial rule. Was the topic of Kenya's past as a British colony discussed among the king and queen and the leaders of Kenya?
Well, I think they talked about, obviously, before he came, they did say that the king will address some of the issues that are related with the history, you know, the colonial past. And he did that. He, at the state banquet, he did in his speech, as you know, he did express deepest regret for what he had described as abhorrent and unjustifiable acts of violence committed against Kenyans during their independence struggle. He had addressed that. He had talked about that. But obviously, some in the country were feeling a little disappointed that he didn't go further than that by maybe even issuing a full apology or proposing reparations. Just to go back a little bit, 10 years ago, we know that Britain had acknowledged some of the acts that were committed during what they called the emergency time, which was in the 1950s, I think it'd be between 1952 and 1960, during the Mau Mau uprising. And they had compensated some of the people by giving, I think, maybe about 3,500 to about little over 5,000 people who were affected. At the time, that was welcome, the fact that Britain had acknowledged the issue of treatment of some of those people during the uprising. But they didn't think that basically took care of the pain and suffering and the long-term effects that some of the members of the communities who were part of this uprising, it didn't take care of that with $3,500. It was not enough. A lot of the events that I participated in, you know, like let's say they visited a library at the Eastlands Library, and people who met them were super excited. They felt special. They felt honored that the king and the queen decided to come and visit. And the fact that they stopped by a local library, you can see it in their faces, you know, and in the interviews that I've done with them. And another one is that he also visited like Karura Forest. It was something that he did to basically talk about the importance of green spaces in cities. And Karura Forest is like this big urban forest right in the middle, in the heart of Nairobi.
That was correspondent Mariama Diallo in Nairobi. That's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, for more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more issues in the news. Until then, I'm Rick Pantaleo.